Tonight on Arena, Marco Rowe and Cathy Belton on a new production of Ghosts from Landmark and the Abbey Theatre, and new albums from boy genius David Kitten-Arcs up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You see, I was so excited there, I couldn't see the three albums for just a minute. Eventually, I got to them. Excited about the first item we have this evening. When the Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen wrote Ghosts in 1881, about a family haunted by bisexual secrets, such was the moral outrage in Scandinavia that the premiere took place in Chicago a year later. The play was also banned in London and Dublin at that time. Now, Marco Rowe has adapted Ghosts for a production he's directing himself for Landmark Productions at the Abbey Theatre. Cathy Belton plays Mrs. Alving, a respectable widow about to open a children's orphanage in her husband's name 10 years after his death. Her son Oswald, played in this production by Callum Lynch, has returned for home for the occasion. And the local pastor, Pastor Manders, played here by Declan Conlon, has arrived to do the honours. Ghost, as I said, is presented by Landmark Productions and the Abbey Theatre. Delighted to have adapter and director Marco Rowe and Cathy Belton, who plays Mrs. Alving, both in studio with me this evening. And I suppose first things first, Mark, why Ghosts and why right now?
So I saw Ghosts for the first time about 10 years ago. Never read it before, had no idea what it was about. And so I went in completely blind, expecting to see something dry and slow, and I was just mesmerised. I couldn't believe the amount of revelations and secrets and amazing plot twists that were coming out of it. Mm. And I found it just so, one of those stories that it begins and it gets increasingly tense, and it's like a noose around your neck. It's tightening and tightening and tightening. And every time you think it's going to stop, it doesn't stop. Mm. And I was really incredibly blown away by it, and I thought it was really good production. And
Did you immediately start to think, I'd like to adapt that?
I was working on another play of mine at the time, and I found it just very inspiring in terms of how well plotted it was, and it kind of gave me a bit of a push. But a few years later then, I was doing The Approach, which Landmark also produced, which Cathy was in with Dervla Crotty and Aisling O'Sullivan.
Yes, remember.
And we did it several times, across that period. So I would see the actors a bit now and again, and I was having coffee with Cathy one day, and we were just talking generally about theatre. And with actors, there's always like the parts that they want to play, like Hamlet or King Lear or whatever. And just out of interest, I asked Cathy, what's the part you always wanted to play?
So let her answer it right.
Okay,
now. Right now.
Yeah, and I said, I've always wanted to play Mrs. Alving when I grow up. And I remember reading it in college years ago and being blown away. I've never seen a production of it. Mm. But I just thought it was so ahead of its time, and it spoke to me. I guess over the last few years, it's been a great space to kind of think about things. And this play kept literally haunting
knocking
me,
at
going,
you.
It's a play about trying to suppress the past. And suddenly all around us, like, you know, there was the mother and baby home scandal, there was the Toon babies. I just felt this urge that the past was, if we don't deal with it, it was coming out of the ground to be dealt with.
Yeah, and while we don't want to give too much away in terms, because there are loads of plot twists in
huge.
It. It's one of the things in it. But we have, maybe give us Mrs. Alving's basic setup. I mentioned some of it there in the introduction of where she's at when we meet her. And the sort of things that are scraping silently inside her head.
It's kind of extraordinary. It happens over one day. And so we see her at a stage in her life where she's about to open this orphanage, and she thinks she can finish with the past, relabel it, and decide that this is her life. Her husband was honourable and everything's going to be fine from now on. And then her beautiful son, the love of her life, comes home, and news is given to her that will change her life forever. And there is unbelievable, shocking consequences.
Yeah.
And that's when her whole life is questioned, her journey about what truth is and living her best self. So that's why I always wanted to play it.
Yeah.
And that's why I said it to Mark. And Mark went, funny you should say that.
Now we'll bounce the ball back.
Yeah. Well, so I suppose sometimes you get thrown a lot of ideas. People come and say, do you want to do this together? Would you like to write this or that? And most of the time you've great reasons to say no. And sometimes you need to be persuaded into something or, you know, to go away and think about it. But Kathy said it, and like I immediately just went, I said, I'm going to adapt that for you. And it was so simple. One, because I love the play, obviously. So the play had kind of come around 10 years later. So it had all obviously been working on me subconsciously. But when Kathy said, I literally just said, I'll adapt that for you. And for reason one, because I love the play. Reason two, because Kathy's an amazing actor. But reason three, because she was just absolutely perfect.
Great casting for the part.
And it was just, it was a complete no-brainer. And that was, that was kind of coming into COVID.
Yeah.
So we didn't kind of do it with a with a production company or with a theatre. I just kind of said, look, I'll start working on it.
Yeah.
And of course, the amazing Anne Clark, I gave it to her to read, and she said, absolutely.
Let's go for it. And I mean, the first thing, I suppose, you have to make a decision straight away about whether you stay in 19th century Norway or whether you do some kind of updating or whether you transpose it to some kind of Irish setting. What decisions did you make in and around that set of parameters?
It's a great question, but an awful lot of our understanding of the play as we sit down and watch it is dependent on certain social rules that existed at one time that don't exist now. So if you updated the play and said it now, it would be very hard for an audience to believe, because people don't behave that now, like that now. And then
there's a very strong church presence in the play around Pastor Manders and the kind of control that he has over the entire community.
Yeah. And then, you know, I toyed with the idea of maybe making it a little bit more Irish or maybe giving a sense that it might be set in Ireland. But I felt that the Irish persona or the Irish psyche was very much a psyche that was even though the church was kind of controlling people, we had a much more kind of life in us and much more a sense of wanting to fight back against that kind of thing, even though many people didn't. And it just didn't quite fit our psyche. So we just put it in it was set in 1881. Norway, you know?
And I think what's so brilliant about this adaptation of Mark has stripped it back to its essence. And there's been, I've never seen a production, but I've been many adaptations. He's brought it back to a very potent core. And I think it's very clear of Mrs. Alveen's. She has a huge realization halfway through that this was her fault and she has to accept the consequences in order to pursue her truth. And I've never seen it so clear before.
Yeah, because one of the big issues, I mean, I don't think we give anything away in the saying of this, is how much of the past she has had to bury. Yeah. She has had to cover it up. And it's expected of her.
Yeah.
Society expects it of all of society, but particularly of the wife of this wonderful, you know, stalwart of the community. Her duty as a wife is to continue honouring him.
Absolutely.
I suppose that's as relevant today as it ever was.
Absolutely, Sean. Duty and obligation. I mean, it's probably one of the greatest enemies if you don't really believe your truest self. And that's what I think this play is doing, is really asking us to address our own human truth and condition. And there is consequences for what happens, shocking consequences. But I think it's worth it to see this woman strive for truth.
But also, she is a very forward thinking woman.
Huge.
She reads. She's reading around the theorists of the day, the social theorists, the philosophers of the day.
Yeah.
Which is not pleasing to Pastor Manders at all. Why would you need to be reading stuff like that? There's no cooking. There's no recipes in that, in any of those books. It's kind of the attitude.
Yeah, it's great. It's feminism. It's, you know, it's evolving herself into a better woman. And I often think with Mrs. Alveen that she is the grown-up version of Hedda and Nora.
Hedda Gabler and Nora in
had
Adult's
stayed
House.
With their husbands.
Yeah.
You know, we see this woman trapped in the marriage. She never walked out the door. But my Christ, in her mind, she is growing and exploring and pushing boundaries, which is kind of amazing to play.
And the thing that strikes me particularly about Oswald, I suppose, who's the son, who's an artist himself, it's difficult not to think of that as him more than any other character, possibly Mrs. Alveen as well, but as him being the kind of the voice of Ibsen, if you like, you know, the artist who went away and who's now coming back home. Could you identify with that kind of, that writer's role within it, Mark?
I suppose, but it's maybe that kind of societal behaviour was sort of slightly a little bit more before my time. I think there was more freedom for someone like me. Oswald had to escape to Paris But I think what the play tackles with Oswald and with Mrs. Alving and with most of the characters is that in order, if you're somebody who needs to be your true self against what society demands of you, in this play in particular, it's a very, very, very strict society. Mm. Well, it's a positive thing to do, and it may complete you as a person, or it may make you a fuller and richer person. But there are huge prices, or there are huge risks, let me put it that way. Mm. And you do so at your peril. And that feels, it stops the play from becoming a story about a woman's triumph in terms of liberating herself. It's way more complex than that, which Ibsen always is, obviously.
Yeah, it's more
interesting you pick up, Sean, on Mark and Ibsen. And I think what you do, Mark, is you push moral boundaries in a lot of your plays. When you look
in other plays outside of adaptations.
I see you pushing moral boundaries all the time. It's very exciting to see.
Are you aware of doing that, Mark?
You don't. What happens is you get yourself into a story and you're working through the story, and then you kind of say, well, I could end it this way. I could make the next thing be this. Which is maybe what people want, but which is the simpler ending. And you always end up seeing the other side of a situation and saying, oh, I've got to go down that road now and explore the other side. So you always end up in very interesting kind of moral arguments, which aren't, you know, once you kind of decide to go down one road, you shut the doors on any other ways of looking at something. So I think it's always good to kind of show as many facets of what you're exploring as you can. It gives people more to think about, you know.
The other thing that strikes me with Ibsen in particular is when you're in the adaptation mode, how he gives you wonderfully structured scenes. Yeah. You talked about all these plot twists. He brings a plot twist at exactly the right moment. Yeah. He introduces a new character at exactly the right moment. The character goes off stage. He brings them back on at exactly the right moment. When you're adapting something like that, how aware do you become of those structural aspects?
I hugely worry. You just feel jealous all the time. You just kind of go, all I'm doing is just changing the dialogue. I mean, it's a process of not really of changing or updating the dialogue, but filtering, because usually you're working off a translation that's been very, very faithful to quite an old play. And Ibsen isn't hugely known for the poetry of his language. His language is often very, very basic. So you find yourself, you keep writing it and rewriting it so that when people are talking, it begins to sound like how people talk.
Today, like how people talk in the 21st century.
Well, not exactly, but something, because it's obviously set 140 years ago, but it would have the fluidity of what we're used to hearing today, even though it's a slightly more archaic type of language. And so that's tough enough in itself. But in terms of, as you say, the plots and the twists and turns, they're just an amazing kind of a scaffolding to hang your working your way through his story.
You don't have to set a whole new framework out. The framework is there. You can play around with.
Yeah.
Is it kind of like changing the decor? I don't want to minimise it. Is there a touch of that about it?
A little bit, but it's much. I don't want to sound pretentious, but it really, it's more than that in the sense that you really have to filter it through your own music and rhythm and sensibility and how you hear people speaking and how you hear theatrical speak. So it's very much you work your way through and you feel your way through it, and then you read back what you've done and you see what doesn't chime right, and then you attack that again. But you're always attacking it on an instinctive level. You're not academically going, I need to put this here or put that there. You just go for it again and you try to feel your way through, say, you know, four or five lines, and eventually you read it back and you go, yeah, that's there now. I can, do you know what I mean? I can flow through that now, but you got to do that across a whole play.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And the another thing that, I mean, it is a well-made play. That's what it is. And as Mark is describing it, he seems to be respecting that well-madeness within it, Cathy. And I've heard a lot of people, and maybe it's the point I'm at as much as anything else, referring to, you know, the need to get back to, or to certainly not ignore the old-fashioned, well-made play and what that can bring to the stage and to audiences.
Yeah, I think we, first and foremost, we crave stories. I think, you know, human beings, first of all, stories, and then stories told so well. And there is something about, like, a meat and two veg play with an act, one and beginning, middle and end. That's not to say we have to keep pushing boundaries.
Yeah.
But I think, like, there is a reason why we keep doing classics, because they're still speaking to us today. And to be able to play those parts and and play them in 2023 is very exciting, where they're still as potent and as dangerous as they were when they were written.
And you're directing here as well, Mark. I mean, I know I've asked you this question before about previous plays of your own that you've directed. Is the writer, is he on holidays now at the moment?
Yeah, he has to be. Except for if an actor looks for a line change. Then you can just, yeah, then phone you can just him do up. It. You don't have to phone the writer. Yeah.
Sean, he's not on holidays.
All right. But no, I suppose that it is a different role when you're in the rehearsal room, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think it only happened the first thing I ever directed where I mistook what my job was, and I learned quickly enough that that wasn't the case. And you do have to throw the writer out, and it has to be about, it's somebody else's job to watch the script. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's about what the actors are creating. And I absolutely love directing, and a lot of people love directing for the power, but it's not about power, it's about collaboration. And it's fantastic to go into a room and everyone has an equal creative kind of component. Mm. And what you discover is that when you have really amazing actors, which we really have with this.
Yeah, we should actually say, Kathy playing Mrs. Alving. How do you refer to the daughter? What name are you? What way
Regina.
Are you?
Regina, yes. We chose the simplest pronunciation.
Several pronunciations for that in different productions.
Yeah.
Simone Collins, Pastor Manders, the guy who's in charge, or thinks he's in charge at any rate, played by Declan Conlon. Then the father of Jacob Eggenstrad, the father of the young girl. It's the Simone Collins character is Lorcan Cranach, and then Callum Lynch playing the part of Oswald, the son. Yeah. In fact, I was talking to Finbar Lynch and Niamh Cusack just the
other night about
the fact that he was there. But that's an extraordinary cast.
It's a great cast.
There's
and
a great energy in the room. There's a real questioning of taking it apart. And
But you sort of feel you've got to go into a room and do an awful lot of work, but you've got five or six collaborators there who take an awful lot of the work off you because their instincts are so strong, their intelligence is so sharp. And also each person who's playing whatever character they're playing has a far greater obsession with an understanding of that character than you will ever have. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because they only have to take care of that character. So they dig really, really deep. So it just makes things really easy.
And having wanted to play the role for a while, now that you're in the middle of her, as it were, how is Mrs. Alving unfolding for you, Kathy?
It's really scary and challenging and exciting, but it's really nourishing, Sean.
She's
great.
She's incredible. She's going to be absolutely incredible.
Oh, God. I'm very, very lucky to be surrounded with such great actors and amazing director and writer. So if I mess it up, Sean, it'll be my fault totally.
And I'm just wondering, Mark, about... directors now listening to you saying, oh, I have to get, the writer has to be shoved out of the room. Right. If somebody takes it upon themselves to direct a play of yours, will you allow them to treat the writer the way you treat the writer?
God, that's a tough one. It's really tough because I think if somebody else was to direct a play of mine, I'd have to leave the country for a while because I'd be too curious and you wouldn't want to have me in the room. So it'd be better for me just to keep my distance and maybe be on the phone if they needed to call about something.
Yeah, so you'd be on the phone whether they call or not.
Maybe.
What stage are you at this point? Where are you in?
We're at the end of week three.
Week three.
And then production week after that. We're in a good place. We're making great progress. And I just wanted to add something to what Kathy was saying or what we were talking about in terms of a meat and two veg play. This play is kind of white hot, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's really
very dangerous.
Really thrilling and terrifying and dangerous. Did you say dangerous?
Dangerous.
Yeah. So it is quite a traditional play, but it's a real kind of turbocharged version of it in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sounds like I'm giving myself a compliment there. I don't mean it that way.
No, you're talking about Ibsen, I think, as
talking
much
about
as
Ibsen.
Anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think it's one of his best plays. I don't understand why it's not done. And then I understand why it's actually so terrifying. I think, you know, you really have to commit to it. I think audiences will be uncomfortable in the best possible way.
Yeah, mind you, I did see some. It came to Dublin in 1917 and the reviewer concluded in 1917, the theatre is a place for the clean things of life. Not for ghastly ghosts of diseased imaginations.
Oh, wow. I love it.
That's from 1970.
That's brilliant.
Well, let's see now if we've evolved in any way since then. Yeah.
Will we disgrace ourselves once again?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. There's a touch of that about it. Well, listen, thank you both so much for coming in. Great to speak to you both.
Pleasure,
best of luck with it all. Really looking forward to seeing it. That's Marco Rowe's adaptation of Ibsen's Ghosts. It's at the Abbey Theatre. It opens on the 19th of April, previews from the 15th, and then runs through until the 13th of May. And you can get full details on abbeytheatre.ie. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. From The Godfather to The Sopranos, mafia stories have tended to focus on the men who rule by fear. The Good Mothers, a new series on Disney Plus, set in Calabria and based on a true story, sets out to show the perspective of the women inside the mafia. Here, three women turn against everything they know in order to fight for their lives, the future of their children, and overcome a criminal empire. Declan Burke has been watching The Good Mothers. He's with me in studio this evening. It is a very interesting perspective that we're given here, in that we see everything that's happening from the point of view of the wives and the women involved in the various families. It's a new angle that we haven't seen before.
Well,
Declan,
completely, Sean. I mean, you referenced The Sopranos and The Godfather. They're probably the best two in the intro. And we are well used to seeing women, if they're referenced at all, they're, you know, on the arms of these gangsters and so forth, and their accessories and yada yada. I mean, The Sopranos was probably a little bit better in terms of its female characters, but here the female characters are very much to the fore. It is their story, and it's not just the mafia wives and daughters, as the case is, but also a mafia prosecutor who, in 2009, after the murder of a so-called mafia wife, she came up with the bright idea that the 'Ndrangheta is the southern Italian mafia, and ruled by fear, as you referenced. Brutal misogyny is important to the code of the 'Ndrangheta. And it was seen as a way of keeping everybody in their place. And the prosecutor thought, well, what if this really powerful tool is their big downfall? What if that is the flaw in their system?
And that prosecutor was Anna Colacci. And this is all based on a true story, or a set of true stories, I suppose, fictionalised to a certain extent. We start with a mother and daughter, actually, in Milan. We make our way to Calabria eventually. This mother and daughter in Milan. And from the outset, I don't know how they create this tension, but from the very moment it starts, we meet the mother and daughter in a car, and I was nervous from the minute it started.
I totally agree. The tension the whole way through is superbly maintained. There is a real claustrophobia to this series, Sean, throughout. But physically, when we meet the Lea Garofalo, who's the mother, and Denise, who's her teenage daughter, they are travelling to Milan, and even the brief snippets of conversation, Leah, the mother, tells her daughter, we're not a threat anymore. Mm. And you realise, so obviously there's not something in her past has not gone well. And we realise she's been in the witness protection programme for 7 years, and she has testified against her husband, Carlo, and is travelling to Milan, a neutral venue, we would have thought, for a sit-down, as they say in media, in mafia parlance, rather. And she believes she's on safe ground. She's going to talk to her husband, Carlo, and he's going to lift whatever kind of threat that lies over and allow herself and her daughter to have a normal life.
And to be fair to you, you kind of, well, why would she go there? She realises that her daughter needs a relationship with her father, and therefore she's prepared to open up that channel of communication. Again, she disappears very quickly, and we don't know where or how, certainly in the section that I've seen. I think you too, we don't know what has happened to her.
We don't, and this is part of the horror of Denise's experience.
The daughter.
Because Denise is the 17-year-old daughter. She has been taught to mistrust her father by her mother, and with good reason, but she wants to believe that he is a reformed character. But Carlo takes Leah, the mother, out to dinner, and Denise goes to have dinner with her cousins. And then Carla comes back with this nonsense. We're going to bring you to the station. Your mother seems to have run off. She went for cigarettes and I haven't seen her. Oh, she was always a hippie, you know. And Denise is going, There's something very, very wrong here. But she, of course, she's powerless because, you know, there's two or three men, they're she knows their potential for violence and so forth. She doesn't have any agency in the situation, and especially when one of them is her father, the man she's supposed to be able to trust.
And then the action switches down to Calabria, which is the toe of the boot.
Indeed.
Exactly where we are in terms of Italy. We meet a range of families there, but we meet them through the eyes of the women in the families again.
Yeah, so one of the main characters that develops in the first series, and more so in the second episode, Giuseppina, Juicy, as she's referred to, and we first meet her when she's doing pickups, protection money. She's zipping around on a motorbike, and we're thinking this is tough lady. And then she's off, and she's in a cocaine processing plant, and we think this is a young woman who's very well connected. And then she takes home the protection money to this remote farmhouse, and there's another sit down with a lot of the men sitting around the table, and we realise that Juicy, her husband, who's in the mafia, is in prison. So she's expected to do all his duties, plus raise her three daughters, and plus put up with the kind of physical and verbal abuse that is meted out by her own father in front of the rest of the family. You start to realise the extent to which these women are being crushed and crushed and crushed. And you do wonder, how long can this go on?
So you have all sorts of pressure coming on them from within the family itself. But what sounds like a great idea from the prosecutor, Anna Colace, to involve the women, that becomes another source of pressure on top of them. What she asks them basically to spy for her.
Well, she does and she doesn't. I mean, Anna Colace, the prosecutor, she walks into a huge room of men who have spent years and years trying to prosecute the mafia in vain, and she's the only woman in the room. So she thinks like a woman. This is not to be sexist about it, but she's thinking, if all these women have been treated that badly, surely one of them, if not two or three or four, are going to be chafing under the pressure they're under. So why don't we target the women? So they put them under surveillance. They start to find out things about the women themselves. So there may be a covert affair going on, for example. There may be a relationship that wouldn't bear scrutiny that might actually get this woman killed if it came to light. So it's not just that she's, you know, trying to make friends with these women on their own. There is an extent to that. But you're absolutely right. Suddenly these women find themselves caught in a vice, Sean, trapped between the men who will kill them if they believe that they're likely to betray them, and also trapped by the prosecutor and the forces of law and order who are putting them under pressure to betray the mafia. It's an impossible situation.
And one of the most impressive things for me in the first episode was the fact that there was some physical violence. It wasn't a huge amount of physical violence, but very understated. And the tension that's created, in fact, is the fear of something happening rather than the thing itself happening, which is what we might be used to from The Godfather and The Sopranos and, you know, other gangster films or mafia films.
Yeah, it was the routine, prosaic nature of the violence, and the way that it was accepted, because there's no other choice but to accept it. Because if you protest against, you know, having your face mashed into your dinner in front of your children at the dinner table, then what comes next? And it was just a sense that there was generation upon generation upon generation bearing down on these women. And as I say, it's only a matter of time before someone snaps, if she's given the opportunity, if she sees a light at the end of the tunnel.
The temptation when you're watching something like this, I think, is to go off and Google and see what happened to the people. But the series itself really, from what I've seen of it, it knows when to give you another little bit of story just to hold on to it. So my advice, and would yours be the same, is stay away from Google. Don't go looking up what happens to characters.
Yes. I mean, obviously, being a consummate professional, Sean, I did have to check a couple of things out, and I did Google around, and I kind of wish I didn't for a couple of reasons. One, because some of the violence is excruciating. Another is that it does spoil the way that the way the series is crafted. We talked about the claustrophobia, the tension. It is brilliantly made. And physically, the way it's lit, the way that these people are crammed together. This is not a classic mafia film in the sense that there's a lot of glamour, there's a lot of money washing around. People live in these wonderful mansions and so forth. We get one glimpse of what we might call a palatial residence, where there's a party taking place. This is in the second episode. Otherwise, these people live in cramped apartments, in rundown houses. They're living down in alleyways. This is a grim existence for everybody except for those at the very, very top. So it's not as if even buying into this, the family and the family and loyalty, you know, slogan and so forth, you know, guarantees you a better life. This is something you simply have to put up with because there's no other choice.
Yeah, so it's a very realistic, there's no kind of romanticising around what's happening here.
Quite the opposite. This is the anti-romantic version of the mafia. And not a moment too soon, some would say, but this is a warts and all version of the Indrangheta.
You've seen two episodes. I'm guessing you can't wait to see them.
Oh, absolutely. It's a 6-part series, Sean. It's phenomenally well done. You know, The Sopranos is the gold standard for TV about the mafia, if I can say that. This is the anti-Sopranos, but every bit as good, and I would hugely recommend
it. I have a funny feeling you won't be hearing loads of opera music while you're seeing violence happening somewhere or other.
Indeed.
It's not going to work that way. Thanks for that, Declan. That's Declan Burke speaking to us about The Good Mothers, a 6-part series which begins on April 5th on Disney+. And we round off the week as usual with our album reviews. First up, no, it's not the Traveling Wilburys, but it is a new kind of supergroup. We'll hear about the debut album from Boy Genius, a collaboration between three of the biggest acts of their generation, Phoebe Bridgers, Lucy Dacus and Julien Baker. We'll follow that, Boy Genius, with potentially what we could call another man genius. The genre-defying David Kitt has been synonymous with Irish music scene since his 2001 debut. He returns now with his 9th album. It's called Idiot Check. What new tricks does Kitzer have up his sleeve? We'll be finding that out later. And we'll round it all off with the Brighton-based alt-rock group Arx. That's A-R-X-X. They've been making waves since their first EP release in 2018. Millions of streams later, with big support slots and critical acclaim from the likes of NME under their belt, they released their debut album. It's called Ride or Die. Zara Hederman, Simon Marr have been listening. Let's start with a little bit of Boy Genius, and what track am I going to go with? Not Strong Enough is what I've decided on.
Black hole opened in the kitchen. Every clock's a different time.
Not Strong Enough, the track there from Boy Genius, and an album simply called The Record. Phoebe Bridgers, Lucy Dacus, Julien Baker forged huge solo careers for themselves, but there they are, united under the banner of Boy Genius. Debut album called The Record. Highly anticipated is an understatement in the case of this particular album. Give us a sense of the three of them in as separate artists, first of all, if you would, Zara.
Yeah, absolutely. So each of them all came up around the same time in the mid-20 kind of tens, and they've all had around 3 albums, very much of a slightly similar wheelhouse. Very emotionally charged, very vulnerable lyrics, and to that quite like bright indie pop arrangements, as we heard, something quite similar to Not Strong Enough. But with each of them, production, I would say, is their strong house. They do very interesting arrangements sometimes in production. Phoebe Bridgers in particular with her Punisher album does very engaging stuff, and they are absolutely massive, as you said. And the fact that this is a supergroup is, cynically, from my own part, no surprise. And we'll see whether it works or not.
And your biggest favourite of the three is, of course, Phoebe Bridgers.
No, it's not. but I actually...
You have it in for Phoebe, do you?
I don't. I will say that this album did slightly endear me to her a little bit. Oh. And it did actually make me kind of realise the prowess she has with production and instrumentation. Now, I will say, her voice is my main issue with her. The inflection does not do it for me. And I do think her singing does kind of come a bit of cropper against two others, strong vocalists.
Okay, fair enough. So yes, but no, but is kind of what you're saying there. Simon, did you have a favourite among the three, or how did you come to this album?
Do you know, I was surprised at how much I liked it. Having listened to the three of them, and particularly in sort of in much more recent, and in the last year or two, really. But what I found is that the key to any supergroup is being able to make it actually be more than the individuals.
Right. You know, did it do that?
Well, I think it does. I think that's the thing. It's very, very surprising, because because so often it doesn't, because the egos get in the way or just the styles are either so too similar or too different. But I think they have enough that is going on. Like Phoebe Bridgers is probably that slight, that bit more reflective, you know, or chilled out, whereas Julian Baker then rocks out that little bit more as well. And it's the combination that seems to work. And it's funny that they almost come together. Country rock is the wrong word, but there's a distinct country twang to a lot of the delivery in this as well.
Yeah, because as often happens when I come in and I hear it on the great speakers in here, I hear far more detail than I hear on the speakers at home. And in what the song we just heard, I suddenly heard the harmonies that I loved in the opening track, Without You or Without Them, which is almost like a kind of a little introduction, 1 minute, 21 seconds. Beautiful, close harmonies. And I kind of, where's that gone for a long time? But it's there in that song, and maybe it's just buried somewhere in the production. Is that the problem, Zara?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a problem. That was kind of an aspect to this album that drew me to it kind of closer and actually made me excited to go back to it. And like, you have songs like, I think, is it Satanist, where the first start of it, I really did not like that song until it then shapeshifted to that outro, which, as I was saying earlier, it had that kind of Phoebe Bridgers tinge on the Punisher element of that album that she had in 2021. But I really liked, you know, it's sweet country song. There's a really nice subtle banjo to it.
Yeah.
The synth kind of accompaniments across this album, I think, work very well. They don't envelop what they're doing. They don't envelop their sounds or like take away from it. And actually with that opening song, I thought that was fabulous. Like I loved hearing that song.
Yeah, no, when I said I missed the harmonies in the other songs, but I'm only hearing them properly when I get on the big speakers in here.
Yeah, I don't know. I do think they were quite prominent throughout.
All right. Well, you've got a better sound system than me. Okay. They're also singing about Leonard Cohen. Let's have a listen.
On the young ramp, you said, if you love me, you will listen to this song. And I could tell that you were serious, so I didn't tell you you were driving the wrong way on the interstate until the song was done.
This existential crisis. What a wonderful rhyme to get into the midst of a song about Leonard Cohen. I was asking, Zara, as we were listening to that, whose vocals are to the fore, and yourself and Simon said Lucy Dacus.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case across most of the record?
I think so. And I do think, I know Simon was saying that the three of them work very well together to make a very cohesive kind of collective album. But that was one of my issues actually with it, where I just felt it was a bit individualistic, where especially with the first four songs, I really could sense who was behind what song, and that did kind of make me question why this vehicle exists. But ultimately, Dacus, I think, is the strongest point of this album.
Stars overall, and did it work ultimately for you, Zara?
Surprisingly, it did, and it was a 3.5 for me, and it has made me reappraise Phoebe Bridgers, as we talked about. It's made me want to get a bit more invested into Julian Baker and also just go back to Lucy Dacus because she's brilliant.
All right, she's the one that's kind of heading it for you. So 3.5, what are you saying, Simon?
I was even surprised at how much I enjoyed this, and I think what made me enjoy it the most was, you talked earlier on, Sarah, about the subtlety of it, is that there's so much you could have thrown at this album, you know, and made it sound this big, overblown thing. But I think the three of them are musically aware enough to put something very nice together. So I'm going to give this 4 stars.
4 stars from you. Okay, that's a pretty solid outing. David Kitt is our second album this evening. Idiot Check. Love the title of the album. You couldn't pin David Kitt down if you tried in terms of genre, really, Simon.
No. Could you?
What has he done over the past 20 years? You've got 3 seconds.
Well,
you've got about 15 or 20 seconds to tell me.
It's when he released 20 in 2021. You know, I kind of went, nah, there's no way, because there's no way Small Moments was 20 years ago. Mm. And then I went back and I dug out the album and I went, oh my goodness, it is. Mm. You know, and he released 4 albums over the course of about 5 or 6 years through a variety of different labels, all of which have aged actually dramatically well. Mm. You know, but then he went through the rigors of the music industry, but went off, and it appears that particularly in the last few years, he has discovered the graw for it again. You know, and this and it has meant that both Use, which I think was 2017, 2018, and now this album, is there's creativity everywhere, but it's really good and it's really melodic, and that's always a good thing.
And who in the world could think of writing a song about Wexford strawberries Only David Kidd. And we're dealing with a little bit of heartbreak here. Briefly, Sarah.
Vaguely, yeah. He did mention that this was inspired by heartbreak, but he also did say that this album isn't entirely autobiographical and that he stems quite a lot of different experiences and memories into one song to make it a bit ambiguous.
All right, sure. We all have so many experiences around Wexford Strawberries, a song of 3 minutes and 56 seconds could possibly encompass all of them. So here's his version of what Wexford Strawberries are all about. There we go, David Kitt and Wexford Strawberries, which gets to Newgrange and has a bit of a kind of a what do we replace religion with question in the midst of the question around which particular punnet of strawberries are you going to buy in the car. And we were talking about the music mix there, Zara. It's very interesting, the kind of different styles, even within that one song.
Yeah, this song, this album as a whole really reminded me of Views, which Simon mentioned earlier. And it also, to me, brought as well his new Jackson project, which leans a lot more into the electronic world.
Yeah.
And I really love how he has melded those two different projects together to create this very idiosyncratic sound. And a sound as well, like Wexford Strawberries there, we heard, is quite tempered. And it's probably one of the most tempered moments on the album. And elsewhere, there's just all so many textures going on that just draw your ear so close to it. And as well, he has Katie Kim as another vocalist. And the two of them working together, there's a great kismet between them because her voice has such a distinct, almost spectral quality to it that really enhances these already very developed atmospheric worlds. Mm. And I really loved coming back to this because I just heard new things every time, which is what you want.
And that mix of, you know, genres, even within a song, is a I suppose that's the trademark
genre of
David Kidd.
Talent. Like when you think of the, you know, the guitar that's there, and as I say, it's almost like a classical guitar with the vocal that's in it. But so many beats and then the drum machines and everything that are in use that were in use on, you know, Small Moments 20 years ago. But it's just that he's developed this more and more now.
And in Wishing Well, again, I know he said these aren't all autobiographical, but he's talking about here, you know, trying to run away from memories and the past.
And how he did it. And what we used to, we'd have a saint for everything, you know, is that no matter what you had a saint for everything or somewhere where you could go and bless it and it would all go away. And what if we replaced that with?
Yeah, this is the one, this is the song where he's asking, I thought it was on Wexford Strawberries. No, this is the one where he's asking all the questions about what do we replace religion with. So it's quite a philosophical record then in that respect, would you say, Zara?
Yeah, it is. And especially with that song, Wishing Well, when it does get to that bit where he's like St. Francis on the road, St. Brendan on the rough seas, that really struck me because David Kidd as well has such a distinct voice as well that sometimes I find that I'm more drawn to listening to actually the production that's going around it, and it can take me a few listens to hear what he's saying. So yeah, that struck me quite a lot.
Let's listen to what he's saying.
We found a patch of shade come out by the roadside.
And the new album, Idiot Check. I think you're both fans of this one, Simon Starrs, and summary from you.
This is a lovely record, I have to say. I was really, really impressed with this and delighted again. Mm. He's one of those artists that you want him to always go on and you want him to really do well. So I'm giving this 4 out of 5.
A solid 4 from you for this one as well. What are you saying in this case, Sarah?
Yeah, well, he said that he experienced a creative purple patch recording this, and listening to it, you can really hear how creatively invigorated he is in this. So it's a 4 from me as well.
A solid 4 from you. All right, let us move on to album number 3, which comes from Arcs. The album is called Ride or Die. It also features our own Pillow Queens. Let's have a listen to the track that features them. This is Call Me Crazy.
Call me crazy, I'm sad all the time. Call me, I'm going out of my mind. Where you gotta be?
That's a little flavour of Call Me Crazy from Arcs and their new album Ride or Die, and that particular track featuring Pillow Queens as well. They're a good match, Arcs and Pillow Queens. Just tell us a little bit about Arcs, who they are and why they fit so well with Pillow Queens, Zara.
Yeah, so they are a duo hailing from Brighton, and actually since they've started releasing music in 2018, along with making music, they've actually been great campaigners for gender diversity within the queer community and queer music scene in Brighton and beyond. And they have quite a a tight connection with the likes of Soak and Pillow Queens, as we heard there. Now, I will say, when I first stuck this album on, Pillow Queens, from the very offset, were immediately what I thought of. So I was not then quite surprised when I saw them feature on that song that we heard. And I will say that that was kind of one of my issues with this album, was that it was just a little bit trend heavy for my liking. The songs kind of sounded a bit formulaic and written for specific instances, like whether it was like for TV kind of placement or like in stadiums, which for a live setting, it's not a problem. And it did kind of work with me. I was singing along with some of the hooks because they do have a very astute ear for a hook. But I just wish that they had have been a bit more varied in their music, because their earlier EPs, I thought anyway, had a lot more of their distinct personalities in them.
You're nodding. Are you nodding in agreement there, Simon?
You get the feeling with them, like they're kind of in that sort of pop rock indie everything world, and they have the confidence. They've obviously got great confidence in their own ability. They can write a great hook, but you wonder sometimes, do they know what it is that they want to be? Or are they, as Zara says, that they're following an awful lot of trends around? Because when they get it right, the singles are particularly good, and the EPs that they've released before, you know, are really, really good, and their live shows are you know, they almost go down in history in terms of the energy that they manage to create. And you think with that confidence, sometimes you'd love them to be just a little bit braver about what it is that they actually are.
Hanny Pittock is the vocalist and guitarist here, and Clara Townsend the drummer here. That's an interesting instrument. Combination, and the drums do drive sections of this in really good ways.
Absolutely. And I will say that with each return, it was Townsend's drumming that kept my interest there, because she offered so much variety across, from lovely muffled softer percussion moments to then those big driving propulsive sets as well. That just wasn't enough for me.
And ultimately, was Phoebe Bridgers involved here, or were you just reminded of her?
I was reminded of her.
Bad way or a good way?
That tone, Sean. There was just moments where lyrically on Not Alone, where I thought of Phoebe Bridgers, and then Stuck on You, the production reminded me of her. And again, that was just me kind of saying that arcs, I feel, are pegging their mass to quite trend heavy music.
All right, I take out
there you go.
Points or stars even.
I was slightly disappointed with the lack of personality and originality in this, so it's a 2 for me.
And Simon?
Okay, I think I probably liked it a little bit more, but I think what it was, it's an album of a number of highlights, and those highlights are particularly good and enough to make me want to hear album number 2, but make me want to think, do the thing, be whatever you are. So I'm going to give them a 3.
A solid 3 from Simon on that one. Ride or Die, the title of the Arcs album. Idiot's Check from David Kitt. And The Record from Boy Genius. The 3 albums we had this evening, Zara Hederman and Simon Marr with their opinions on them. That is our lot for this Friday. Indeed, for this week, Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you on Sunday, 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock on RT Lyric FM. Back with you as usual here on RT Radio 1 on Monday evening at 7. Have a great weekend. John Creedon will be with you after the news.